The chaos in the West eventually led to Galerius calling the Imperial Conference of Carnuntum. There, Galerius appointed his friend Licinius to the rank of full Augustus, and directed him to defeat the usurper Maxentius in Italy. Galerius's Caesar and nephew, Maximinus Dia, resented the entry of Licinius into the Imperial College at the higher rank, and spent the next year squabbling with his uncle over his own imperial title. This discord between the rulers granted the Eastern Christians a second respite from the Great Persecution. Just like in the Western churches, though, peace and harmony did not follow. As you'll recall, even prior to the respite in late 308, the Church of Egypt was already beginning to fracture due to the actions of Meletius of Lycopolis. Meletius had been ordaining clergy and performing episcopal duties outside his diocese in order to restore parish life, first in the Thebaid and then in Lower Egypt. His intentions may have been honorable, but Meletius had performed these actions without the approval of Peter of Alexandria. Phileas of Thmuis and three other imprisoned bishops of churches Meletius was active in wrote him a letter of rebuke. As we saw previously, Phileas kept in contact with his church and eventually became a martyr, as did the other three bishops. Despite the letter, the bishop of Lycopolis continued his actions. Following the martyrdom of Phileas and the others, Meletius finally made his way to Alexandria. There, Meletius gained allies, possibly local opponents of Peter, who put him in contact with two presbyters that the Coptic Pope had originally appointed as parish visitors. Though the exact timing is uncertain, Meletius appears to have elevated these two men to the episcopate, one for the confessors in prison, and the other for the confessors in the mines. Meletius himself was eventually deported to the mines of Phano in Palestine, probably in 308 or 309, where he ordained the second former parish visitor. Peter of Alexandria was already aware of Meletius's activities even before he again returned to the city. The Pope wrote a letter to the Alexandrians denouncing Meletius for invading his church and instructed the local Christians to completely withdraw from communion with the Bishop of Lycopolis. By this time, the conflict between Peter and Meletius had moved beyond merely the illegal ordinations. As had been the case in Rome and Africa, the issue of the lapsed proved to once again be the most cantankerous and divisive issue facing the early church. Peter's canonical letter back in 306 should have settled the matter, but Meletius was clearly able to gather many to his cause. The question is, why? Peter had attempted to forge a moderate path which gave mercy to the lapsed, but also showed solidarity with the confessors and martyrs. But the Pope's canons still upset many within the Egyptian church for being too lenient. Some scholars have detected a linguistic and social divide here. On the one hand, you had the urban, Greek-speaking Church of Alexandria, with its emphasis on education and philosophy. On the other hand, you had the Coptic-speaking Church of the rural peasantry, whose literary world was mainly biblical, not Hellenistic, and who held a more rigorous and apocalyptic Christian faith. We've seen shades of this before, such as Dionysius of Alexandria's diminution of the Book of Revelation during a schism which followed the Valerian persecution. Also remember that Alexandria was effectively a Greek island in an Egyptian sea. The native Egyptians had long resented the Greek city which ruled over their ancestral homeland. Though we should perhaps not push this distinction too hard within the early Egyptian church, it is worth noting that Peter's successors will go to great efforts to unify the Coptic Christians under the leadership of the Alexandrian papacy. But that is for another day. For now, it seems that tensions between Alexandria and Egypt were manifesting in the conflict over the lapsed between Peter and Meletius. Once the respite following the Conference of Carnuntum set in, Peter once again returned to Alexandria. There, he summoned a church council which formally condemned, deposed, and excommunicated Meletius. And so, the Meletian schism was now official. Peter and his supporters regarded the Meletians as schismatics who had broken from the Catholic Church, while the Meletians viewed themselves as the true church and styled themselves as the Church of the Martyrs. The Meletian schism wasn't the only source of discord within the Eastern churches at this time. Despite the great persecution, theological controversy was still possible, and it arose once again over the theology of the great 3rd century scholar and presbyter Origen of Alexandria. I won't get too far into the theological weeds of this Origenist controversy just yet. We'll save that for an upcoming episode. Controversy over Origen was not new, of course, and seems to have been brewing for some time. You may remember Methodius, Bishop of Olympus in Lycia, whom we discussed just before the narrative break. Though he was indebted to some of Origen's writings and ideas, Methodius became a major critic of Origen. Many scholars also believe that Peter of Alexandria, too, was a major anti-Originist. This is less certain, however, given the fragmentary preservation of Peter's writings. More likely, the Coptic Pope was simply critical of some of Origen's ideas, which hardly makes him a major critic of the great scholar. Origen had, after all, remained popular in Egypt and his native Alexandria. As we discussed in an earlier episode prior to the narrative break, the so-called first monk of the world, Antony of Egypt, displays Originist and Platonic Christian ideas in his letters. We've also noted that the catechetical school of Alexandria was led by two successive Originist presbyters, Theognostus and Pierius. The same Pierius who had compromised himself during the persecution, but before that was the teacher of Pamphilus of Caesarea. Pamphilus was a devoted Originist. He had come from a noble family in Beirut before becoming a student of Pierius and adopting the philosophic life. You'll remember that at Caesarea, Pamphilus had set himself to the task of preserving Origen's legacy and maintaining his Christian school and library, a project in which he was joined by his students, chiefly his spiritual son, Eusebius. As we saw two episodes ago, Pamphilus had been imprisoned back in 307. Thus, it was from prison that, with the aid of Eusebius, he authored his Apology for Origen in 5 books. The precise circumstances for the apology are not entirely certain, but the version most scholars seem to accept is as follows. Origen had been under criticism for quite some time by the current successors of the bishops who had condemned the great heresiarch Paul of Samosata during the Council of Antioch back in 268. These were the bishops of Cappadocia, Pontus, Cilicia, Palestine, and Arabia. When Egyptian confessors, who had long revered Origen, were sentenced to the mines of Phano, they came into contact with confessors from these other provinces, who were anti-Originist. This caused no small amount of dissension between the confessors. Origen's theology was not only being likened to Paul of Samosata, but also Artemon, and even the great heretics the Church of Alexandria had long had to contend with, the Gnostic Valentinus and the modalist Sabellius. Deeply concerned, the Coptic Christians in the mines contacted Pamphilus, who in turn composed his Apology for Origen to demonstrate to all that the great scholar was perfectly orthodox. We will return to the precise theological issues of this controversy down the road. As we saw in the last episode, Galerius finally conceded the title of Augustus to both Constantine and Maximinus Daya. Maximinus was especially pleased, as he was now second in the Imperial College after his uncle, and his rival Licinius had been demoted to fourth in rank. With their relationship now patched up, Galerius and Maximinus recommenced with the Great Persecution in the autumn of 309. As I mentioned during his introduction, Maximinus was arguably the worst of the persecutors, since he possessed not only his uncle's pagan devotion and extreme hatred of Christianity, but also the creative and strategic mental faculties to channel those sentiments into effective policy. As historian Harold Drake puts it, Maximinus, quote, persisted in the persecution with a resourcefulness and initiative rarely witnessed at the imperial level, devising new ways to demoralize Christians psychologically as well as physically. Unquote. Maximinus recognized that it wasn't enough to simply torture and execute Christians who refused to sacrifice. The 40-year period of toleration in the latter half of the 3rd century had seen the Christian church grow and embed itself into Roman society. Earlier persecutions had witnessed popular hostility towards Christians in concert with government action. In marked contrast, local pagans during the Great Persecution had thus far not manifested the anti-Christian sentiments of earlier generations. Indeed, many average pagans had Christian friends or even family members, as we saw with Bishop Phileas. The First Tetrarchy had done much to revive the worship of the immortal gods, and Maximinus understood he needed to continue this policy. It was not enough to persecute Christians. Traditional pagan piety needed a revitalization. Maximinus's first initiative in this project came in the autumn of 309, when he issued what has sometimes been called the Fifth Edict. The emperor ordered his praetorian prefect, provincial governors, and military commanders to direct local magistrates to repair pagan temples and once again compel all the people of their cities to offer sacrifices and libations. Furthermore, no one was permitted to buy or sell anything in the public markets unless it had first been sprinkled with sacred sacrificial blood. Guards were also ordered posted at the public baths to make sure that anyone who entered was sprinkled with the sacrificial blood. The new policy was well conceived. Restoration of the great Greco-Roman temples was a strong, visible sign of the vitality of traditional paganism. The call for citizens to display their piety by offering to the gods in these restored temples was also a revivalist-style move. But it was the use of sacrificial blood which really added something new to the mix. The blood of sacrificed animals was sacred to pagans, and anything it was sprinkled upon was sanctified. People, products, and food were therefore made holy and cleansed of impious pollution by the blood. The theological meaning of this command was exactly the opposite from the Christian perspective. Pagan sacrifice was the polluting element for Christians. In their eyes, it made them and anything it came into contact with unclean and demonically tainted. Indeed, Maximinus and his advisors may have known more about the Christian religion than perhaps realized. Had not controversy arisen back during the days of the Apostle Paul over Christians eating meat sacrificed to idols? Had not the book of Revelation foretold that the beast would require people to have his mark in order to buy or sell? We don't know if Maximinus was aware of these biblical texts, but many Christians certainly interpreted his actions through this lens. In addition, targeting the public markets and baths also marginalized Christians socially and economically. The emperor was going beyond merely the command to sacrifice. He was trying to make daily life so unbearable for Christians, they would capitulate and worship the gods. On November 13th, 309, three Christians in Caesarea named Antoninus, Zebinus of Eleutheriopolis, and Germanus rushed towards the governor of Palestine as he was sacrificing. They shouted to him to cease from this error, declaring that there was no god but the one creator of the universe. Firmilianus asked them who they were, and they confessed the name Christian. Without trial or torture, the governor had them executed at once. On the same day, another Christian was executed, a young virgin and confessor named Anatha of Scythopolis. She had been brought to Caesarea for her refusal to sacrifice, and prior to her trial, had been viciously tortured by the tribune Maxus. The tribune had the young woman stripped from the waist up, and proceeded to publicly display Anatha through the marketplaces, flogging her all along the way. Finally, she was brought before the governor's tribunal, and after confessing her faith, Firmilianus had her burned alive. Not only did the governor forbid Christians to bury these martyrs, he also had their bodies left out before the gates of the city. Guards were posted to prevent Christians from recovering the remains, which were subsequently eaten by dogs and birds. According to Eusebius, this act of desecration resulted in a miraculous sign where, on a clear day, the pillars of public buildings emitted water, weeping, as it were, for the dishonored martyrs. During the next month, a group of Egyptian Christians attempted to journey north to the mines of Cilicia in order to bring food to the confessors there. They were arrested by guards at the gate of the city of Ascalon, and then brought before the governor in Caesarea on December 14th. Firmilianus decided that if they wanted to go to the mines, so be it. He then proceeded to deprive many of them of the use of their right eye and left foot. However, three were executed, probably the group's leaders. A certain Ares, who was burned alive, while the other two, Elijah and Promas, were beheaded. The following year, a renowned young ascetic and confessor named Peter Absalom, from the village of Ania near Eleutheriopolis, was brought before the governor. His model of life amazed all, even Firmilianus. Some urged him to desist and save his life, while others encouraged him to remain steadfast. Peter chose the latter, and on January 10th, he was burned alive alongside, interestingly enough, a Marcionite bishop named Asclepius. Another reminder that it wasn't just the members of the great church who suffered under the persecution. On February 16th, after having spent over 2 years in prison, Pamphilus of Caesarea finally gained the crown of martyrdom. He was brought before the tribunal with two of his companions who had been imprisoned with him. These were the elderly deacon Valens from Jerusalem and the confessor Paul of Jamnia, who had previously been branded with hot irons. They were joined by five Egyptian confessors who were part of the group which had previously tried to travel to Cilicia. They had all adopted biblical names in place of the ones their pagan fathers had given them: Elijah, Jeremiah, Isaiah, Samuel, and Daniel. The Egyptians were tried first, subjected once more to all sorts of torture devices and machines, as Firmilianus interrogated them. The confessors continued to declare their home was Jerusalem, meaning the heavenly Jerusalem. The governor was at first alarmed, thinking the Christians had a secret insurgent base somewhere. He was apparently ignorant of the fact that the Greek polis, Aelia Capitolina, had once been called Jerusalem 2 centuries earlier. After various scourgings and lacerations, the Egyptians were finally beheaded. Next, it was Pamphilus and his two companions who were brought before the judge's seat. Firmilianus, being made aware of the prolonged imprisonment and torture the three men had suffered, contented himself with only asking them to sacrifice. When they refused, Firmilianus sentenced them all to be beheaded. Pamphilus and his two companions were thus finally counted among the martyrs. Just as this occurred, a young man, having not even reached the age of 18, shouted from the crowd, requesting the governor give him the bodies of the three martyrs. His name was Porphyry, and he was a catechumen and devoted student in Pamphilus' household, skilled in penmanship. The governor paid no heed to this request, and instead had the boy's sides lacerated down to the bone and even organs, to the point that Porphyry appeared to be nearly dead. After this had gone on for some time, Firmilianus had Porphyry's flayed sides scratched with coarse animal furs, before finally ordering the lad to be burned on the pyre. Three more Christians were executed for acts of sympathy towards Pamphilus and his companions. First was the Cappadocian Seleucus, formerly an officer in the Roman army and a longtime confessor. Another was the elderly Theodulus, a slave in the governor's household, whom Firmilianus singled out for crucifixion. Finally, there was another catechumen named Julian, also from Cappadocia. Thus, in total, Firmilianus executed 12 Christians that day. After their deaths, their bodies were also all left out in the streets to be devoured by birds and beasts. But after 4 days, the bodies had remained untouched, and so the Christians were able to gather their remains and give them a proper burial. Eusebius records two final martyrs in Caesarea during this period. Two Christians from Bashan, named Hadrian and Eubulus, arrived at the city to visit the confessors. They were arrested, and when their purpose was discovered, Firmilianus exhorted them to sacrifice. When they refused, the governor first had their sides combed before exposing them to the beasts of the arena. Hadrian died first on March 5th, followed by Eubulus 2 days later. According to Eusebius, a respite for the Christians in Caesarea Maritima set in shortly afterwards, though the reasons for this are not known. Over in Egypt, the persecution had worsened under the new governor. The infamous persecutor Clodius Colchianus appears to have ended his prefecture in 307. It may have seemed to the Christians of Alexandria and Lower Egypt that nobody could have been worse than Colchianus, but they were wrong. In 310, the new prefect of Egypt was none other than Sosionis Hierocles. You remember Hierocles. He was the governor of Bithynia, who had written the anti-Christian tract, Lover of Truth, and advised Diocletian to launch the persecution in the first place. Just as Galerius may have appointed him for his known anti-Christian sentiments, so too it's likely Maximinus Dia honored him with the prefecture of Egypt in recognition of their shared contempt for Christianity. On April 8th, either in 310 or 311, Hierocles was enjoying his time on the tribunal by gleefully passing sentences against the Christians brought before him. The most vile was his condemnation of consecrated virgins to infamous brothel keepers. This was too much to bear for a certain confessor present. His name was Odysseus, and he was the brother of Eusebius's friend, the martyr Apphianus of Lycia. Odysseus possessed a great classical education and wore the philosopher's pallium. He had been a confessor in the mines of Phano before he had come to Alexandria. When he heard Hierocles sentence his Christian sisters to sexual violence, Odysseus could no longer stand idly by. He rushed upon the prefect and proceeded to strike Hierocles on the face, all the while rebuking him for his actions. The prefect's guards pulled Odysseus away from Hierocles, and the Lycian was subsequently subjected to various tortures before finally being cast into the sea. One last thing we shall mention with regards to events in Egypt at this time was the presence in Alexandria of an important figure we introduced prior to the narrative break. In 306, after 2 decades of anchoresis, Antony of Egypt, the so-called first monk of the world, emerged from his place of isolation at the abandoned military fortress on Mount Pisper. We'll discuss Antony's later life in more detail in a future episode, but shortly after emerging, the father of the monks acquired many disciples and the monastic movement began to take off in Egypt. Though the exact year is uncertain, sometime between 306 and 311, Antony left his monastic dwelling and traveled to Alexandria with some of his disciples. The monk desired to care for the martyrs, and even become a martyr himself. Though he did not deliberately provoke his martyrdom, Antony nonetheless acted boldly before the authorities. He cleaned his tunic to draw attention to himself, ministered openly to the confessors in prison, and publicly accompanied the martyrs all the way from the tribunal to their execution. Many Christians in Alexandria were in awe at the spiritual life of Antony, and knowledge of monasticism spread. Even the prefect of Egypt took notice, but he demurred from executing Antony or his followers, ordering them instead to be expelled, first from his court and then from the city. Antony, in the end, was not martyred, and instead survived the persecution. In time, the monastic way of life he was pioneering would provide many Christians with a new path toward martyrdom, a daily martyrdom, whose practitioners would come to be seen as the spiritual successors to the martyrs and confessors of earlier times. Returning to the Holy Land, persecution continued in Palestine in the military zone and in the copper mines of Phano. On September 19th, 310, a group of 150 confessors, mostly Egyptians but also Palestinians, who had been condemned to the copper mines, gathered in nearby Zoar. There they actually built a makeshift church, recited scripture, and worshipped God. Upon hearing of this, the military officer in charge of the mines immediately set out against them. Some were permanently kept in Zoar, others sent back to Phano, and still others were exiled to different regions. The officer, however, arrested the ringleaders, four Egyptians, two of whom were bishops named Pelias and Nilus, another a presbyter named Elijah, and finally a devoted layman named Patermuthius. The dukes of Palestine decided to make an example out of these four and ordered them all burned alive. The final martyrs Eusebius records for this period were executed in early May. First among them was Silvanus, the venerable and aged bishop of Gaza. A Roman veteran, Silvanus converted to Christianity following his discharge from the military. Silvanus had endured contests in the arena at Caesarea before he was finally sent to the mines of Phano. There he was joined by a blinded Egyptian confessor named John, who had memorized large swaths of the scriptures. Eusebius recalls witnessing the sightless John give long recitations from memory to the wonderment of all. On May 4th, 311, an order from Maximinus was received, which instructed the overseer to execute any old or sickly Christian prisoners in the mines. Silvanus, John, and a total of 38 other Egyptians were beheaded on that day. The period from 309 to 311 had witnessed the worst bouts of persecution thus far. So it was certainly a surprise to the Eastern Christians when, in May of 311, another respite was granted, one which was meant to officially end the Great Persecution itself. During the previous spring, Galerius, the senior Augustus and prime mover behind the persecution, was preparing to celebrate his Vicennalia the following year when he was struck with a horrific disease. The exact nature of his illness is not certain, but based on the gruesome details provided by Lactantius, the emperor appears to have had some severe form of bowel or genital cancer. Galerius's body began to waste away as his hapless doctors tried to save his life. The immortal gods were beseeched, but no relief came. Soon, worms began to eat away at his internal regions. According to Lactantius, the stench was so horrible that it pervaded not just the palace, but the entire city of Sirtica. By the spring of 311, knowing that death was near, Galerius was compelled to concede defeat and acknowledge the failure of the persecution. Just as the Christian god had struck down Decius and Valerian, so too, it seemed, the same fate had befallen himself. Galerius issued the Edict of Toleration in the name of the entire Imperial College. The law was posted up in Nicomedia on April 30th, 311. In the edict, Galerius defended the original decision to launch the persecution. He stated that the persecution had been done for the good of the empire, and that the emperors had rightly sought to compel Christians back to the old gods. But many Christians had resisted, and now they were neither worshipping the traditional deities nor their own god. So the emperor declared he would display his humane clemency by allowing Christians to be Christians again and assemble for worship and construct churches, provided they stayed out of all other trouble. Galerius closed the edict by asking his Christian subjects to pray for his health and the welfare of the empire. If Galerius had hoped his newfound clemency would cause the Christian deity to heal him of his affliction, he was wrong. Knowing he was on death's door, Galerius set out from Sirtica to his birthplace of Remilianum on the Danube River. He was loyally accompanied on the journey by Licinius. The dying emperor entrusted to his imperial colleague his wife, the Augusta Valeria, daughter of Diocletian, and his illegitimate son, Candidianus. Galerius didn't live long enough to see his home city, though. In the early days of May 311, Galerius finally expired in great pain, becoming the second of the four persecuting emperors to die. Licinius escorted his comrade's body to Remilianum, where the dead Augustus was buried. So that's it then, right? Constantine and then Maxentius decreed official toleration in the West back in 306, and now Galerius has done the same for the East. After 8 bloody years, the Great Persecution is finally over, right? Unfortunately, no. Despite his uncle's edict, Maxiministia will refuse to surrender. And less than 6 months later, Christianity will once again be a capital crime in the Eastern Empire. This will prove to be the last phase of the persecution, however. Next episode, we'll return to the West and begin our account of the events which finally brought an end to the Great Persecution. Events which began when the Emperor Constantine looked up in the sky and beheld a heavenly sign.